He figured he knew how to set up a naval exercise, one of those grand training evolutions in which half of 7th Fleet would administratively attack and destroy the other half, followed by the simulated forced entry landing of a Marine battalion. Navy fighters would tangle with Air Force ones, and after it was all over, computer records would show who'd won and who'd lost, and bets of various sorts would be paid off in various bars. And there'd be some hard feelings, because fitness reports, and with them careers, could ride on outcomes of simulated engagements. Of all his services, Mancuso figured his submarine force was in the best shape, which made sense, since his previous job had been comm sub pack, and he'd ruthlessly whipped his boats into shape. And besides, the little shooting war they'd engaged in 2 years before had given everyone the proper sense of mission, to the point that the crews of the boomers who'd laid on a submarine ambush worthy of Charlie Lockwood's best day still swaggered around when on the beach. The boomers remained in service as auxiliary fast attacks because Mancuso had made his case to the CNO, who was his friend Dave Seaton, and Seaton had made his case to Congress to get some additional funding. And Congress was nice and tame, what with two recent conflicts to show them that people in uniform did have more purposes than opening and closing doors for the people's elected representatives. Besides, the Ohio-class boats were just too expensive to throw away, and they were mainly off doing valuable oceanographic missions in the North Pacific, which appealed to the tree, actually fish and dolphin in this case, huggers, who had far too much political power in the eyes of this white-suited warrior. With every new day came his official morning briefing, usually run by Brigadier General Mike Lahr, his J-2 intelligence officer. This was particularly good news. On the morning of 7 December 1941, the United States had learned the advantage of providing senior area commanders with the intelligence they might need. And so this sink pack, unlike Admiral Husband E. Kimmel, got to hear a lot. "Morning, Mike," Mancuso said in greeting, while a chief steward's mate set up morning coffee. "Good morning, sir," the one-star replied. "What's new in the Pacific?" "Well, top of the news this morning, the Russians have appointed a new guy to head their Far Eastern Military District. His name is Gennady Bondarenko. His last job was J-3 Operations Officer for the Russian Army. His background's pretty interesting. He started off in signals, not a combat arm, but he distinguished himself in Afghanistan toward the end of that adventure on their part. He's got the Order of the Red Banner, and he's a hero of the Soviet Union. Got both of those as a colonel. He moved rapidly up from there. Good political connections. He's worked closely with a guy named Golovko. He's a former KGB officer who's still in the spook business and is personally known to the president. Ours, that is. Golovko is essentially the operational XO for the Russian President Grushevoy, like a chief minister or something. Grushevoy listens to him on a lot of issues, and he's a pipeline into the White House on matters of mutual interest. Great, so the Russians have Jack Ryan's ear via this guy. What sort of mensch is he? Sink Pack asked. Very smart and very capable, our friends at Langley say. Anyway, back to Bondarenko. The book on the guy says he's also very smart and also very capable, a contender for further advancement. Brains and personal bravery can be career-enhancing in their military, just like ours. What sort of shape is his new command in? Not very good at all, sir. We see 8 division-sized formations, 6 motor rifle divisions, 1 tank, and 1 artillery division. All appear to be under strength on our overheads, and they don't spend much time in the field. Bondarenko will change that if he goes according to the form card. Think so? As their J-3, he agitated for higher training standards. And he's a bit of an intellectual. He published a lengthy essay last year on the Roman legions. It was called Soldiers of the Caesars. It had that great quote from Josephus, "Their drills are bloodless battles, and their battles are bloody drills." Anyway, it was a straight historical piece, sources like Josephus and Vegetius. But the implication was clear. He was crying out for better training in the Russian army, and also for career NCOs. He spent a lot of time with Vegetius's discussion of how you build centurions. The Soviet army didn't really have sergeants, as we understand the term, and Bondarenko is one of the new crop of senior officers who's saying that the new Russian army should reintroduce that institution. Which makes good sense, Lahr thought. So you think he's going to whip his people into shape? What about the Russian Navy? They don't belong to him. He's got frontal aviation, tactical aircraft, and ground troops, but that's all. Well, their navy's so far down the shitter they can't see where the paper roll is, Mancuso observed. What else? A bunch of political stuff you can read up on at your leisure. The Chinese are still active in the field. They're running a four-division exercise now south of the Amur River. That big. Admiral, they've been on an increased training regimen for almost 3 years now. Nothing frantic or anything, but they've been spending money to get the PLA up to speed. This one's heavy with tanks and APCs. Lots of artillery live-fire exercises. That's a good training area for them, not much in the way of civilians. Kinda like Nevada, but not as flat. At first, when they started this, we kept a close eye on it, but it's fairly routine now. Oh, yeah? What do the Russians think about it? Lahr stretched in his chair. Sir, that's probably why Bondarenko drew this assignment. This is backwards from how the Russians trained to fight. The Chinese have them heavily outnumbered in theater, but nobody sees hostilities happening. The politics are pretty smooth at the moment. Mm-hmm, Sinkpak grunted behind his desk. And Taiwan? Some increased training near the strait, but those are mainly infantry formations, and nothing even vaguely like amphibious exercises. We keep a close eye on that with help from our ROC friends. Mancuso nodded. He had a filing cabinet full of plans to send 7th Fleet west, and there was almost always one of his surface ships making a courtesy call to that island. For his sailors, the Republic of China was one hell of a good liberty port, with lots of women whose services were subject to commercial negotiations. And having a gray U.S. Navy warship tied up alongside pretty well put that city off limits for a missile attack. Even scratching an American warship was classified delicately as a casus belli, a reason for war. And nobody thought the Chi-Coms were ready for that sort of thing yet. To keep things that way, Mancuso had his carriers doing constant workups, exercising their interceptor and strike fighter forces in the manner of the 1980s. He always had at least one fast attack or boomer slow attack submarine in the Formosa Strait, too, something that was advertised only by casual references allowed to leak to the media from time to time. Only very rarely would a submarine make a local port call, however. They were more effective when not seen. But in another filing cabinet, he had lots of periscope photos of Chinese warships, and some hull shots, photos made from directly underneath, which was mainly good for testing the nerve of his submarine drivers. He'd also occasionally had his people track Chi-Com submarines, much as he'd done in Dallas against the former Soviet Navy. But this was much easier. The Chinese nuclear power plants were so noisy that fish avoided them to prevent damage to their ears, or so his sonarman joked. As much as the PRC had rattled its saber at Taiwan, an actual attack, if opposed by his 7th Fleet, would rapidly turn into a bloody shambles, and he hoped Beijing knew that. If they didn't, finding out would be a messy and expensive exercise. But the Chi-Coms didn't have much in the way of amphibious capability yet, and showed no signs of building it. So, looks like a routine day in theater? Mancuso asked, as the briefing wound down. Pretty much, General Lahr confirmed. What sort of assets do we have tasked to keep an eye on our Chinese friends? Mainly overheads, the J-2 replied. We've never had much in the way of human intelligence in the PRC, at least not that I ever heard about. Why is that? Well, in simplest terms, it would be kind of hard for you or me to disappear into their society, and most of our Asian citizens work for computer software companies, last time I checked. Not many of them in the Navy. How about the Army? Not many, sir. They're pretty underrepresented. I wonder why. Sir, I'm an intelligence officer, not a demographer, Lar pointed out. I guess that job is hard enough, Mike. Okay, if anything interesting happens, let me know. You bet, sir. Lar headed out the door, to be replaced by Mancuso's J-3 operations officer, who would tell him what all his theater assets were up to this fine day, plus which ships and airplanes were broken and needed fixing. She hadn't gotten any less attractive, though getting her here had proven difficult. Tanya Bogdanova hadn't avoided anything, but she'd been unreachable for several days. "You've been busy?" Provalov asked.
"Duh, a special client," she said with a nod. "We spent time together in St. Petersburg. I didn't bring my beeper. He dislikes interruptions," she explained, without showing much in the way of remorse. Provalov could have asked the cost of several days in this woman's company, and she would probably have told him. But he decided that he didn't need to know all that badly. She remained a vision, lacking only the white feathery wings to be an angel. Except for the eyes and the heart, of course. The former cold, and the latter non-existent.
"I have a question," the police lieutenant told her.
"Yes?"
"A name. Do you know it?" "Clementi Ivanich Suvorov." Her eyes showed some amusement.
"Oh, yes. I know him well."
She didn't have to elaborate on what "well" meant. "What can you tell me about him?"
"What do you wish to know?"
"His address, for starters."
"He lives outside Moscow."
"Under what name?"
"He does not know that I know, but I saw his papers once. Ivan Yurievich Konev."
"How do you know this?" Provalov asked.
"He was asleep, of course, and I went through his clothes," she replied, as matter-of-factly as if she'd told the militia lieutenant where she shopped for bread.
"So he fucked you, and you in turn fucked him," Provalov didn't say. "Do you remember his address?" She shook her head.
"No, but it's one of the new communities off the Outer Ring Road."
"When did you last see him?"
"It was a week before Grigory Filipovich died," she answered at once. It was then that Provalov had a flash.
"Tanya, the night before Grigory died, whom did you see?"
"He was a former soldier or something. Let me think. Pyotr Alexeyevich something."
"Amalric?" Provalov asked, almost coming off his seat.
"Yes, something like that. He had a tattoo on his arm, the Spetsnaz tattoo a lot of them got in Afghanistan. He thought very highly of himself, but he wasn't a very good lover," Tanya added dismissively.
"And he never will be," Provalov could have said then, but didn't.
"Who set up that, appointment?" "Oh, that was Clementi Ivanich. He had an arrangement with Grigory. They knew each other, evidently for a long time. Grigory often made special appointments for Clementi's friends."
Suvorov had one or both of his killers fucked the whores belonging to the man they would kill the next day.
Whoever Suvorov was, he had an active sense of humor. Or the real target, actually, had been Sergei Nikolaevich. Provalov had just turned up an important piece of information, but it didn't seem to illuminate his criminal case at all. Another fact which only made his job harder, not easier. He was back to the same two possibilities. This Suvorov had contracted the two Spetsnaz soldiers to kill Rasputin, and then had them killed as insurance to avoid repercussions. Or he'd contracted them to eliminate Golovko, and then killed them for making a serious error.
Which?
He'd have to find this Suvorov to find out. But now he had a name and a probable location, and that was something he could work on. Chapter 19. Man-hunting. Things had quieted down at Rainbow Headquarters in Hereford, England, to the point that both John Clark and Ding Chavez were starting to show the symptoms of restlessness. The training regimen was as demanding as ever, but nobody had ever drowned in sweat, and the targets, paper and electronic, were, well, if not as satisfying as a real human miscreant, wasn't the best way to put it, then maybe not as exciting was the right phrase. But the Rainbow team members didn't say that, even among themselves, for fear of appearing bloodthirsty and unprofessional. To them the studied mental posture was that it was all the same. Practice was bloodless battle, and battle was bloody drill. And certainly, by taking their training so seriously, they were still holding a very fine edge. Fine enough to shave the fuzz off a baby's face. The team had never gone public, at least not per se. But the word had leaked out somehow. Not in Washington, and not in London. But somewhere on the continent, the word had gotten out that NATO now had a very special and very capable counter-terrorist team that had raped and pillaged its way through several high-profile missions, and only once taken any lumps, at the hands of Irish terrorists, who had, however, paid a bitter price for their misjudgment. The European papers called them the Men of Black for their assault uniforms, and, in their relative ignorance, the European newsies had somehow made Rainbow even more fierce than reality justified. Enough so that the team had deployed to the Netherlands for a mission 7 months before, a few weeks after the first news coverage had broken. And when the bad guys at the grammar school had found there were some new folks in the neighborhood, they'd stumbled through a negotiating session with Dr. Paul Bellow and cut a deal before hostilities had to be initiated, which was pleasing for everyone. The idea of a shootout in a school full of kids hadn't even appealed to the Men of Black. Over the last several months, some members had been hurt or rotated back to their parent services, and new members had replaced them. One of these was Ettore Falcone, a former member of the Carabinieri sent to Hereford as much for his own protection as to assist the NATO team. Falcone had been walking the streets of Palermo in Sicily with his wife and infant son one pleasant spring evening, when a shootout had erupted right before his eyes. Three criminals were hosing a pedestrian, his wife, and their police bodyguard with submachine guns. And in an instant, Falcone had pulled out his Beretta and dropped all three with headshots from 10 meters away. His action had been too late to save the victims, but not too late to incur the wrath of a capo mafioso, two of whose sons had been involved in the hit. Falcone had publicly spat upon the threat, but cooler heads had prevailed in Rome. The Italian government did not want a blood feud to erupt between the mafia and its own federal police agency. And Falcone had been dispatched to Hereford to be the first Italian member of Rainbow. He had quickly proven himself to be the best pistol shot anyone had ever seen. "Damn," John Clark breathed, after finishing his fifth string of 10 shots. This guy had beaten him again. They called him Big Bird. Ettore, Hector, was about 6'3" and lean like a basketball player, the wrong size and shape for a counter-terror trooper. But Jesus, could this son of a bitch shoot!
"Grazie, General," the Italian said, collecting the 5-pound note that had accompanied this blood feud.
And John couldn't even bitch that he'd done it for real, whereas Big Bird had only done it with paper. This spaghetti eater had dropped 3 guys armed with SMGs, and done it with his wife and kid next to him. Not just a talented shooter, this guy had 2 big brass ones dangling between his legs. And his wife, Anna Maria, was reputed to be a dazzling cook,
In any case, Falcone had bested him by 1 point in a 50-round shoot-off, and John had practiced for a week before this grudge match.
"Ettore, where the hell did you learn to shoot?" Rainbow Six demanded.
"At the police academy, General Clark. I never fired a gun before that, but I had a good instructor, and I learned well," the sergeant said with a friendly smile. He wasn't the least bit arrogant about his talent, and somehow that just made it worse.
"Yeah, I suppose," Clark zippered his pistol into the carrying case and walked away from the firing line.
"You too, sir?" Dave Woods, the rangemaster, said as Clark made for the door.
"So I'm not the only one?" Rainbow Six asked.
Woods looked up from his sandwich.
"Bloody hell, that lad's got a fucking letter of credit at the Green Dragon from besting me," he announced.
And Sergeant Major Woods really had taught Wyatt Earp everything he knew. And at the SAS Rainbow Pub, he'd probably taught the new boy how to drink English bitter. Beating Falcone would not be easy. There just wasn't much room to take a guy who often as not shot a possible or perfect score.
"Well, Sergeant Major, then I guess I'm in good company."
Clark punched him on the shoulder as he headed out the door, shaking his head. Behind him, Falcone was firing another string. He evidently liked being number one, and practiced hard to stay there. It had been a long time since anyone had bested him on a shooting range. John didn't like it, but fair was fair, and Falcone had won within the rules. Was it just one more sign that he was slowing down? He wasn't running as fast as the younger troops at Rainbow, of course, and that bothered him too. John Clark wasn't ready to be old yet. He wasn't ready to be a grandfather either. But he had little choice in that. His daughter and Ding had presented him with a grandson, and he couldn't exactly ask that they take him back. He was keeping his weight down, though that often required, as it had today, skipping lunch in favor of losing 5 paper pounds at the pistol range.
"Well, how did it go, John?"
Alistair Stanley asked, as Clark entered the office building.
"The kid's real good, Al," John replied, as he put his pistol in the desk drawer.
"Indeed. He won 5 pounds off me last week."
A grunt.
"I guess that makes it unanimous."
John settled in his swivel chair, like the suit he'd become.
"Okay, anything come in while I was off losing money?"
"Just this from Moscow. Ought not to have come here anyway,"
Stanley told his boss, as he handed over the facts.
"They want what?"
Ed Foley asked in his 7th-floor office.
"They want us to help train some of their people," Mary Pat repeated for her husband. The original message had been crazy enough to require repetition.
"Jesus, girl, how ecumenical are we supposed to get?" the DCI demanded.
"Sergei Nikolaevich thinks we owe him one.
And you know..." He had to nod at that.
"Yeah, well, maybe we do, I guess.
This has to go up the line, though." It ought to give Jack a chuckle, the deputy director operations thought. "Shit," Ryan said in the Oval Office, when Ellen Sumter handed him the facts from Langley. Then he looked up.
"Oh, excuse me, Ellen."
She smiled like a mother to a precocious son.
"Yes, Mr. President."
"Got one I can..."
Mrs. Sumter had taken to wearing dresses with large slash pockets. From the left one, she fished out a flip-top box of Virginia Slims and offered it to her president, who took one out and lit it from the butane lighter also tucked in the box.
"Well, ain't this something?"
"You know this man, don't you?"
Mrs. Sumter asked.
"Golovko? Yeah."
Ryan smiled crookedly, again remembering the pistol in his face as the VC-137 thundered down the runway at Moscow's Sheremetyevo Airport all those years before. He could smile now. At the time, it hadn't seemed all that funny.
"Oh yeah, Sergei and I are old friends."
As the presidential secretary, Ellen Sumter was cleared for just about everything, even the fact that President Ryan bummed the occasional smoke. But there were some things she didn't and would never know. She was smart enough to have curiosity, but also smart enough not to ask.
If you say so, Mr. President.
Thanks, Ellen. Ryan sat back down in his chair and took a long puff on the slender cigarette. Why was it that stress of any sort made him gravitate back to these damn things that made him cough? The good news was that they also made him dizzy. So that meant he wasn't a smoker, not really, POTUS told himself. He read over the facts again. It had two pages. One was the original facts from Sergei Nikolaevich to Langley. Unsurprisingly, he had Mary Pat's direct fax line, and wanted to show off that fact. And the second was the recommendation from Edward Foley, his CIA director. For all the official baggage, it was pretty simple stuff. Golovko didn't even have to explain why America had to accede to his request. The Foleys and Jack Ryan would know that KGB had assisted the CIA and the American government in two very sensitive and important missions. And the fact that both of them had also served Russian interests was beside the point. Thus Ryan had no alternative. He lifted the phone and punched a speed dial button. Foley, the male voice at the other end said. Ryan, Jack said in turn. He then heard the guy at the other end sit up straighter in his chair. Got the facts. And? The DCI asked. And what the hell else can we do? I agree. Foley could have said that he personally liked Sergei Golovko. Ryan did too, as he knew. But this wasn't about like or don't like. They were making government policy here, and that was bigger than personal factors. Russia had helped the United States of America. And now Russia was asking the United States of America for help in return. In the regular intercourse among nations, such requests, if they had precedence, had to be granted. The principle was the same as lending your neighbor a rake after he had lent you a hose the previous day. Just that at this level, people occasionally got killed from such favors. You handle it, or do I? The request came to Langley. You do the reply. Find out what the parameters are. We don't want to compromise Rainbow, do we? No, Jack, but there's not much chance of that. Europe's quieted down quite a bit. The Rainbow troopers are mainly exercising and punching holes in paper. That news story that ran, well, we might actually want to thank the putts who wrote it. The DCI rarely said anything favorable about the press. And in this case, some government puke had talked far too much about something he knew. But the net effect of the story had had the desired effect, even though the press account had been replete with errors, which was hardly surprising. But some of the errors had made Rainbow appear quite superhuman, which appealed to their egos and gave their potential enemies pause. And so terrorism in Europe had slowed down to a crawl, after its brief and somewhat artificial, they knew now, rebirth. The men of black were just too scary to mess with. Muggers, after all, went after the little old ladies who just cashed their social security checks, not the armed cop on the corner. In this, criminals were just being rational. A little old lady can't resist a mugger very effectively, but a cop carries a gun. I expect our Russian friends will keep a lid on it. I think we can depend on that, Jack, Ed Foley agreed. Any reason not to do it? Ryan could hear the DCI shift in his seat. I never have been keen on giving methods away to anybody, but this isn't an intelligence operation per se, and most of it they could get from reading the right books. So I guess we can allow it. Approved, the president said. Ryan imagined he could see the nod at the other end. Okay, the reply will go out today. With a copy to Hereford, of course. It arrived on John's desk before closing time. He summoned Al Stanley and handed it to him.
I suppose we're becoming famous, John.
Makes you feel good, doesn't it? Clark asked distastefully. Both were former clandestine operators, and if there had been a way to keep their own supervisors from knowing their names and activities, they would have found it long before.
I presume you will go yourself. Whom will you take to Moscow with you?
Ding and Team 2. Ding and I have been there before. We've both met Sergei Nikolaevich. At least this way he doesn't see all that many new faces.
Yes, and your Russian, as I recall, is first-rate.
The language school at Monterey is pretty good, John said, with a nod.
How long do you expect to be gone?
Clark looked down at the fax and thought it over for a few seconds. Oh, not more than 3 weeks, he said aloud. Their Spetsnaz people aren't bad. We'll set up a training group for them, and after a while we can probably invite them here, can't we? Stanley didn't have to point out that the SAS in particular, and the British Ministry of Defense in general, would have a conniption fit over that one. But in the end, they'd have to go along with it. It was called diplomacy. And its principles set policy for most of the governments in the world, whether they liked it or not.
I suppose we'll have to, John, Stanley said, already hearing the screams, shouts, and moans from the rest of the camp, and Whitehall.
Clark lifted his phone and hit the button for his secretary, Helen Montgomery.
Helen, could you please call Ding and ask him to come over?
Thank you.
His Russian is also good, as I recall.
We had some good teachers, but his accent is a little southern.
And yours?
Leningrad. Well, St. Petersburg now, I guess.
Al, do you believe all the changes?
Stanley took a seat.
John, it is all rather mad even today, and it's been well over 10 years since they took down the red flag over the Spassky Gate.
Clark nodded.
I remember when I saw it on TV, man. Flipped me out. Hey, John, a familiar voice called from the door.
Hi, Al.
Come in and take a seat, my boy.
Chavez, simulated major in the SAS, hesitated at the my boy part. Whenever John talked that way, something unusual was about to happen. But it could have been worse. Kid was usually the precursor to danger. And now that he was a husband and a father, Domingo no longer went too far out of his way to look for trouble. He walked to Clark's desk and took the offered sheets of paper.
Moscow? He asked.
Looks like our commander-in-chief has approved it.
Super, Chavez observed. Well, it's been a while since we met Mr. Golovko. I suppose the vodka's still good?
It's one of the things they do well, John agreed.
And they want us to teach them to do some other things?
Looks that way.
Take the wives with us?
No. Clark shook his head. This one's all business.
When?
Have to work that out. Probably a week or so.
Fair enough.
How's the little guy?
A grin.
Still crawling. Last night he started pulling himself up, standing like. Imagine he'll start walking in a few days.
Domingo, you spend the first year getting them to walk and talk. The next 20 years you spend getting them to sit down and shut up, Clark warned.
Hey, Pop, the little guy sleeps all the way through the night, and he wakes up with a smile. Damn sight better than I can say for myself, you know.
Which made sense.
When Domingo woke up, all he had to look forward to was the usual exercises and a 5-mile run, which was both strenuous and, after a while, boring.
Clark had to nod at that.
It was one of the great mysteries of life, how infants always woke up in a good mood. He wondered where, in the course of years, one lost that.
The whole team? Chavez asked.
Yeah, probably. Including Big Bird, Rainbow Six added.
Did he clean your clock today, too? Ding asked.
Next time I shoot against that son of a bitch, I want it right after the morning run when he's a little shaky, Clark said crossly.
He just didn't like to lose at much of anything, and certainly not something so much a part of his identity as shooting a handgun. Mr. C. Ettore just isn't human. With the MP, he's good, but not spectacular. But with that Beretta, he's like Tiger Woods with a pitching wedge. He just lays him dead. I didn't believe it until today. I think maybe I ought to have eaten lunch over at the Green Dragon. I hear you, John, Chavez agreed, deciding not to comment on his father-in-law's waste. Hey, I'm pretty good with a pistol, too, remember? Ettore blew my ass away by 3 whole points. The bastard took me by 1, John told his Team 2 commander. First man-on-man match I've lost since 3rd SOG. And that was 30 years in the past, against his command, Master Chief, for beers. He'd lost by 2 points, but beat the Master Chief 3 straight after that, Clark remembered with pride. Is that him? Provolov asked. We don't have a photograph, his sergeant reminded him, but he fits the general description. And he was walking to the right car. Several cameras would be snapping now to provide the photos. They were both in a van parked half a block from the apartment building they were surveilling. Both men were using binoculars, green, rubber-coated military issue. The guy looked about right. He'd come off the building's elevator and had left the right floor. It had been established earlier in the evening that one Ivan Yuryevich Konyev lived on the 8th floor of this upscale apartment building. There had not been time to question his neighbors, which had to be done carefully in any case. There was more than the off chance that this Konyev / Suvorov's neighbors were, as he was reputed to be, former KGB. And thus asking them questions could mean alerting the subject of their investigation. This was not an ordinary subject, Provolov kept reminding himself. The car the man got into was a rental. There was a private automobile registered to one Konyev, Ivan Yuryevich, at this address, a Mercedes C-Class. And who was to say what other cars he might own under another identity? Provolov was sure he'd have more of those, and they'd all be very carefully crafted. The Konyev ID certainly was. KGB had trained its people thoroughly. The sergeant in the driver's seat started up the van's motor and got on the radio. 2 other police cars were in the immediate vicinity, both manned by pairs of experienced investigators. Our friend is moving. The blue rental car, Provolov said over the radio. Both of his cars radioed acknowledgments. The rental car was a Fiat, a real one made in Turin rather than the Russian copy made at Tolyattistad, one of the few special economic projects of the Soviet Union that had actually worked, after a fashion. Had it been selected for its agility, Provolov wondered, or just because it was a cheap car to rent? There was no knowing that right now. Konyev / Suvorov pulled out, and the first tail car formed up with him, half a block behind, while the second was half a block in front, because even a KGB-trained intelligence officer rarely looked for a tail in front of himself. A little more time and they might have placed a tracking device on the Fiat, but they hadn't had it, nor the darkness required. If he returned to his apartment, they'd do it late tonight, say about 4 in the morning. A radio beeper with a magnet to hold it onto the inside of the rear bumper. Its antenna would hang down like a mouse's tail, virtually invisible. Some of the available technology Provolov was using had originally been used to track suspected foreign spies around Moscow, and that meant it was pretty good, at least by Russian standards. Following the car was easier than he'd expected. 3 trail cars helped. Spotting a single car tail was not overly demanding. 2 could also be identified, since the same 2 would switch off every few minutes. But 3 shadow cars broke up the pattern nicely, and, KGB trained or not, Konyev / Suvorov was not superhuman. His real defense lay in concealing his identity, and cracking that had been a combination of good investigation and luck. But cops knew about luck. KGB, on the other hand, didn't. In their mania for organization, their training program had left it out,
perhaps because trusting to luck was a weakness that could lead to disaster in the field. That told Provorov that Konev/Suvorov hadn't spent that much time in field operations. In the real world of working the street, you learned such things in a hurry. The tailing was conducted at extreme range, over a block, and the city blocks were large ones here. The van had been specially equipped for it. The license plate holders were triangular in cross-section, and at the flip of a switch, one could switch from among three separate pairs of tags. The lights on the front of the vehicle were paired as well, and so one could change the light pattern, which was what a skilled adversary would look for at night. Switch them once or twice when out of sight of his rearview mirror, and he'd have to be a genius to catch on. The most difficult job went with the car doing the front tail, since it was hard to read Konev/Suvorov's mind. And when he made an unexpected turn, the lead car then had to scurry about under the guidance of the trailing shadow cars to regain its leading position. All of the militiamen on this detail, however, were experienced homicide investigators who'd learned how to track the most dangerous game on the planet. Human beings who'd displayed the willingness to take another life. Even the stupid murderers could have animal cunning, and they learned a lot about police operations just from watching television. That made some of his investigations more difficult than they ought to have been. But in a case like this, the additional difficulty had served to train his men more thoroughly than any academy training would have done.
"Turning right," his driver said into his radio. "Van takes the lead."
The leading trail car would proceed to the next right turn, make it, and then race to resume its leading position. The trailing car would drop behind the van, falling off the table for a few minutes before resuming its position. The trail car was a Fiat clone from Tolyattistad, by far the most common private passenger auto in Russia, and therefore fairly anonymous with its dirty off-white paint job.
"If that's his only attempt at throwing us off, he's very confident of himself."
"True," Provorov agreed. "Let's see what else he does." The "what else" took place 4 minutes later. The Fiat took another right turn, this one not onto a cross street, but into the underpass of another apartment building, one that straddled an entire block. Fortunately, the lead trail car was already on the far side of the building, trying to catch up with the Fiat, and had the good fortune to see Konev/Suvorov appear 30 meters in front.
"We have him," the radio crackled. "We'll back off somewhat."
"Go," Provorov told his driver, who accelerated the van to the next corner. Along the way, he toggled the switch to flip the license plates and change the headlight pattern, converting the van into what at night would seem a new vehicle entirely.
"He is confident," Provorov observed 5 minutes later.
The van was now in close trail, with the lead trail car behind the van, and the other surveillance vehicle close behind that one. Wherever he was going, they were on him. He'd run his evasion maneuver, and a clever one it had been, but only one. Perhaps he thought that one such SDR, surveillance detection run, was enough. That if he were being trailed, it would only be a single vehicle. And so he'd run that underpass, eyes on the rearview mirror, and spotted nothing.
Very good, the militia lieutenant thought.
It was a pity he didn't have his American FBI friend along. The FBI could scarcely have done this better, even with its vast resources. It didn't hurt that his men knew the streets of Moscow and its suburbs as well as any taxi driver.
"He's getting dinner and a drink somewhere," Provorov's driver observed. "He'll pull over in the next kilometer."
"We shall see," the lieutenant said, thinking his driver right. This area had 10 or 11 upscale eateries. Which would his quarry choose?